Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, the death of a Fresno State student this weekend after an alleged night of drinking at a fraternity party raises new questions about underage drinking. And the outbreak of the hantavirus at Yosemite National Park, how it's affecting the park and what's being done to stop the outbreak. First, family and friends are mourning the sudden death of 18-year-old Philip Dannens. Dannens, a Fresno State student, died Sunday after what police say was a night of drinking at a fraternity party. Police are investigating. The 18-year-old was a graduate of Garces High in Bakersfield. Those who know him say he was excited about attending Fresno State. His death has raised new questions about binge drinking, underage drinking, and what goes on at fraternity and sorority parties. Joining us to discuss the issue is Dr. Paul Oliario, Vice President for Student Affairs at Fresno State, and Ralph Blackman. He's President and CEO of Century Council, that is a group of distillers who fight drunk driving and underage drinking. Thank both of you for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having us.
Well, first of all, we do want to say that our thoughts are with the family. And, you know, every parent has got to be wondering right now, because this is pledge season on every college campus across the country. And parents just want to know that their kids are safe. Now, I know, Dr. Oliario, even though frat and sorority houses are off campus, is there anything the university can do to police them better?
Well,
because we're talking about underage drinking, basically.
Well, I think certainly we make every effort to make sure that, you know, one, the risk management policies are in place that would govern any activities that take place, you know, within a fraternity or a sorority, which include limitations on alcohol use, no underage use, and making sure that if there is an event where alcohol is permitted, only 20 individuals 21 years of age or older are there. It has to be monitored. Also, campus police, you know, patrol the areas of the fraternity houses in case there are noise and other things that would draw attention to an event. But as you know, sometimes it's just very difficult to control the individual behaviors of students and of groups. And
well,
that's where we always struggle.
Well, of course, the official cause of the young man's death won't be known until an autopsy is completed. And police are handling the investigation, and they're focusing on who supplied this alcohol. Is that something the university will look at too?
Well, yes. I think we're waiting for the results of the police investigation, and we will follow their lead. But also, we will do our own investigation regarding whether or not the current risk management policies that are in place were violated. And if so, then that fraternity is held accountable by the university as well.
Now, you have suspended recognition of Theta Chi fraternity, right? Or Theta
That's correct. Chi. That was done immediately Saturday morning when we learned of the incident.
Now, what happens next? And depending on the investigation, what kind of penalties could the fraternity face?
Again, depending upon what the police investigation determines and what our own internal investigation determines, the results can be anything from a probation up to a loss of recognition and permanent loss of recognition and a elimination of the chapter from our campus.
Now, to be fair, the international headquarters for Theta Chi fraternity, they did release a statement, first of all, sending their prayers and thoughts to members of the fraternity, family and friends of the young man. They also say that the fraternity has a strict anti-hazing policy and strict guidelines for chapters which prohibit underage alcohol consumption. And they say the fraternity has dispatched senior representatives of their international organization to Fresno to assess the situation, and says the fraternity intends to fully cooperate with local authorities and the administration of California State Fresno. In a situation like this, you have the fraternity saying they prohibit hazing, but as I mentioned, it is pledge season on college campuses across the country. And even though they say they are against hazing, it is still happening within fraternities and sororities, and a lot of it centers around drinking.
Well, it's every fraternity and every sorority has those same policies. They have to have it. It's a campus policy as well, and it's a state law. As we try to ensure everyone understands the dangers of any behavior that is demeaning or requires students to do something they should not. And the consequences are very serious. If, in fact, any chapter is found to have engaged in any hazing, which could include criminal charges, it can also certainly include actions taken against the fraternity as a whole. And that's why we're waiting to see what is determined through the police reports before we take any action.
Now, there was another incident about 7 years ago at Fresno State. Some of us may have remembered a student. He was a former student who was found dead at a fraternity house. He was a victim of alcohol poisoning.
Now, that's correct.
And I remember after that, because there had been some studies done about the level of drinking on the college campus. And at that time, Fresno State undertook a huge education campaign. Do you think that helped?
Well, we hope it does. I mean, we've had a strong and extensive alcohol education campaign for at least the last 10 years that I've been here that involves faculty, staff, students, community members, law enforcement. It's focused throughout the year on many different aspects of helping students to, one, make responsible decisions about any use of alcohol if they are of legal drinking age, and also making them aware of the consequences of drinking if they are not of legal age. And students are very much involved and continue to be involved in those alcohol education efforts. We believe that it has made a positive impact. Surveys that we have done consistently over the last several years, which are national surveys, normed against other campuses, show us that our students tend to drink less often. They tend to drink less when they actually do consume alcohol, and they engage in more what we call protective behaviors. If they do choose to consume alcohol, like always being with a friend, always having a designated driver, counting their drinks, alternating drinks so that they may drink soda instead of just having a beer after beer, also eating food, and trying to engage in other activities other than just drinking. But as you can see, regardless of all the alcohol education efforts we make, it's still up to students to make some responsible decisions. And when they don't, or when fraternities or sororities or any groups violate our policies, they need to be held accountable, and we will do that.
Well, first of all, let's define binge drinking. It's defined as five or more drinks and one sitting for men and four or more for women. Now, right. Mr. Blackman, your group, Distillers Fighting Drunk Driving and Underage Drinking, you know, you are people who sell alcohol. You are in the business. How do you do that? How do you fight against drunk driving and binge drinking?
Well, first, as you said at the beginning, of course, everybody's hearts go out to the family and friends of this young man. It's a tragic event. I'd also like to applaud Fresno State. When we started to work on this issue of binge drinking, especially about 15 years ago, you know, schools around the country didn't all have these kinds of policy in place, number one, and then number two, didn't take on these kinds of educational campaigns and communications campaigns that schools have supplemented with their own activities over all these years. So, you know, the reality is that the policies are in place. The reality is that colleges all over the country, a number of educational and informational activities that are out there. At the end of the day, almost three-quarters of high school students report drinking. So very likely this young man had drunk before he got to college, number one. Number two, The fact of the matter is that you are seeing these days that there are probably almost 4 in 10 students who report in the Monitoring the Future study, which is a national study, that they've been drunk in the last month. From the Century Council's perspective, number one, we've provided resources, Alcohol 101, which is a CD-ROM-based program and a web-based program to schools around the country. Number two, we've provided millions and millions of copies of a pamphlet called Parents, You're Not Done Yet, that schools give away free of charge and that we provide to them free of charge to schools around the country. And number three, we continue to support a variety of activities for administrators, for faculty, for residence life, and for the students themselves, very recently with communications campaigns. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, the students have to decide for themselves that a culture of overconsumption is not really something that they want to be part of. And it continues to persist no differently on a campus like Fresno State than campuses around the country.
You know, I don't have the study in front of me, but I do recall reading it and going over it last night. It was a study done on female college students who drink. And a lot of it said that it was done because there was this feeling of they wanted to belong. This is something they felt they had to do to belong. Now, is there this attitude that you think that college kids are away from home and they're just going to drink?
Well, there are, if you look at it developmentally, you'll find that middle school to high school poses challenges, and you'll find that high school to college poses challenges, where young people, especially as they go from high school to college, who not only have to fit into a new group of students, but also many very likely away from home for the first time. They have to find their way through a social scene that sometimes they overestimate how important alcohol is to that. But that said, what we find is that among college students, 14%, in fact, report that they have consumed 10 or more drinks in a row within the last 2 weeks, and literally 6%, almost, you know, report consuming 15 or more drinks. So it's an area where overconsumption is really not just one too many, but outrageously and dangerously to a level that some students take this. As far as gender is concerned, campus college males report higher rates getting drunk in the past month, about 44% and about 43% binge drinking, compared to females who report about, again, 37% and 32% respectively. But when you get to that really high overconsumption level, it really is a male thing. 24% of college students report having 10 or more drinks versus only 7% of females. So, again, it's a transitional time that's complicated, and that's why schools, and I'm sure Fresno State as well, has a variety of programming, freshman orientation, information from parents for parents and others that try to raise the awareness of students that there are all kinds of ways to find their place in a new culture, a campus culture, but overconsumption is not the way to do it.
Dr. Oliario,
yes.
Could you pick it up from there?
I think there's an important dimension that we have learned just from research on our own campus, because we have tried to get our students' responses to questions related to their own alcohol consumption and attitudes towards alcohol use. And what we find is that there are a lot of misperceptions by students about how much alcohol consumption really takes place and how frequently their fellow students drink. And in fact, students tend to significantly overestimate the amount of alcohol consumption that takes place and overestimate how much their peers are drinking. And so our students have engaged in education campaigns over the past several years using actual data from our survey to let students know that they are not in the minority if they aren't drinking. They are not in the minority if they're drinking very moderately. And I think it helps students understand they don't have to live up to this myth that you have to drink in order to have fun in college, or you have to drink a lot in order to be a part of the peer group. And I think that's helped. It helps put in perspective the fact that alcohol is not the main way to be able to socialize on a college campus these days. And it also makes not drinking as acceptable as drinking for many of our students.
Now, as he mentioned, when young freshman students coming in as freshmen, I know there are orientation programs. Is that something you try to go over with parents and students?
A number of things we try to communicate to students, both in writing as well as through the verbal presentations we make during orientation. And the role of alcohol and the importance of them making intelligent and responsible decisions with regard to alcohol is among them, including letting them know that they're not of legal age to drink and that the consequences are serious if they choose to drink or if they choose to drink and drive in particular.
And there are, Mr. Blackman, there are all sorts of consequences of binge drinking. I mean, young people really do put themselves at risk and even death due to binge drinking.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. As was just mentioned, when you talk about alcohol-related drunk driving fatalities, you know, again, that's probably the largest number of young people who die as a result of drunk driving. About 1,800 college students die each year from alcohol-related unintentional injuries, again, like motor vehicle crashes or even, you know, falling or those kinds of things. It's a startling number. At the end of the day, this period of adjustment passes by. Students tend, again, for the most part, to mature. There is a huge misperception out there as the doctor just mentioned about what the norm is on campus and how somebody wants to be ultimately part of that norm and fit in. This is not an issue that should have arisen in the first place with this young man. Obviously, our suggestion is that from middle school on, this is a topic that parents and kids should be talking about in age-appropriate ways, from the first time that somebody may encounter alcohol and how to deal with peer pressure and be able to have the courage and the confidence to know right from wrong. The legal age is something that, quite frankly, is generally and universally known, what the drinking age is. So in addition to the consequences that may be health-related or, tragically in this case, a life lost, it is a consequence of legal issues, of breaking the law, of monetary fines, again, not just of his own, but if, again, he had gotten behind the wheel where you are also putting somebody else's life either in your own vehicle or in the vehicle next to you at risk as well. So the consequences, if they were off campus, and again, I'm not familiar with the individual instance here, but again, many states also have what are known as social host laws, where there is liability on the part of the property owner. If they were on fraternity house grounds, believe me, liability that fraternity houses have, and that's why the national fraternity has shut them down and taken such decisive action instantly. Because there may be insurance and legal issues still to come once the investigation has taken place.
Dr. Oliaro, it's my understanding that you might have to leave us soon, but so I do have a couple of more questions for you. As he mentioned, talking about the responsibility and the liability for fraternity and sorority houses, even though they are off campus, there are rules governing them, as you mentioned earlier, so what could happen, and what are some of the things that universities try to make clear to these Greek organizations?
Well, you're right, Juanita. They are an off-campus entity. The house is privately owned, and as a result, they have the responsibility of managing their behavior within that house. But the university still establishes expectations for all of our fraternities and sororities for their behavior as representatives of the university and as students, both as individuals and as groups. And those are outlined in what I referred to earlier as risk management policies that have to be in place whenever they engage in any activities. And if those are violated, then they face the consequences that I mentioned earlier. And those consequences could include permanent loss of recognition and elimination of the chapter from the campus, in addition to whatever other individual judicial action may take place if they've also violated campus policies that involve health and safety.
Now, one of the things, in listening to one of the police reports, it's my understanding that they are looking at what was going on at the time. So I think what they're looking at is whether or not, you know, this young man was being encouraged to drink. Now, if something like that, if there's evidence of something like that, what are we looking at?
Well, I think that's why we're waiting to see just what the results of the investigation will tell us, and then we will determine what, if any, violations of our campus policy and code of conduct have occurred. Although, because it does happen off campus, we have to look very carefully at what actions a university can take against individuals, but we certainly can take a look at also what consequences we impose on the fraternities as a whole. And that's why I said we're waiting to see what the final results are before we jump to any conclusions.
Now, what can Mr. Blackman, since your group does deal with education, what can parents do? You talked about starting early, and everybody knows you need to start early talking to your kids. But what about this when they go off to college? You know, parents, there shouldn't be a handoff policy. Parents should still be engaged in their activities and what they do.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, the reality is if you look at the national studies that have been done for 10 years or more, parents are the leading influence in their youth's decisions to drink or not to drink. And a lot of parents are under the misperception that, well, you know, now that they've gotten older, you know, I've done whatever I can do, and, you know, it's really up to them, and they don't listen to me anyway. And the reality is that that's not the case. Parents wield a lot of influence on their both on their teen students as well as on their college age students, and need to not give that responsibility up. Peers play a decidedly important role, but the fact of the matter is that parents are that leading role. Parents set those rules. Parents should be in constant communication with their students. Parents should know and be interested in who they're meeting up with and who their friends are. They should know and be concerned that they're attending classes. They should listen for those signs in their kids' voices, you know, in terms of, you know, whether they're working their issues out with their roommates, many of which have certainly never been thrust into a, you know, a 12-foot room with a person that they've never met before.
Right.
And how do they work out those situations? And how do they manage their time? How do they do their laundry? I mean, these things that all seem so mundane, and that we as adults look back and, you know, and say, you know, they seem so minor, are issues that are good conversation starters for parents and their young people. Back in my day, you know, we called long distance on Sunday afternoons when the rates were lower. And if you talked to your parents once a week, you know, that was about the most of it. But now, you can text your kid, it takes 5 seconds, and they'll answer you back, and that takes 5 seconds. And there's a letting go, there's no doubt about that. But parents are still the most important part of their young person's decision-making situation, and parents really shouldn't give that up just because they've sent their child away to school.
From that description, it sounds like you have been at our summer orientation program for new students, because those are the messages that get
sent. Yeah, I mean, there's that trade-off.
Yeah, that's right. It's a partnership. It was a partnership for those students with their parents to get them to this point in time that they're attending college, and that partnership continues, and it now involves the university. Together, the parents student and the university are here to try to help them achieve their goal of completing their college degree, and that will continue throughout their tenure as a student.
You know, and this is definitely a tragedy for the parents and everyone involved. But again, as you talk about what parents can do, this is an opportune time to take this tragedy and talk to your college-age students or even high school students about consequences again, and look what can happen.
Exactly. Again, this is a parent's worst nightmare, and we have communicated our sympathy and our hearts have gone out to the Dannon's family, and we want them to know we're there to support them. At the same time, you are right. We do want to use this as a teachable moment for all of our other students to not put themselves in a situation and not to put their parents in this kind of a situation.
Right. And so for you, Mr. Oliario, because I know that you have to go, just one more question.
Sure.
When you, because you said right now you're waiting for the investigation, you're waiting for the reports to come back. Do you have any indication how long that might be for you all?
No, I said we are just letting police do their work. We know they will do it thoroughly and carefully. And we said we would wait until we get that before we take any action ourselves.
Okay. Well, thank you both for joining us at this time for this important and timely discussion. Dr. Paul Oliario, Vice President for Student Affairs at Fresno State, and Mr. Ralph Blackman, the CEO of Century Council. Thank you both.
Thank you, Winnie.
Thank you.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno and Cahuilla Delta Medical Center.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Public health officials have traced six cases of hantavirus disease to Yosemite National Park, including two deaths. The outbreak has park officials answering questions from people around the world. The virus is a rodent-borne disease and is transmitted through urine droppings or saliva of infected rodents. At least five of the six cases has been traced back to Curry Village, the popular camping site at Yosemite National Park. And one report says up to 10,000 Yosemite visitors could be at risk of the virus. Joining me is Dr. Vicki Kramer with the California Department of Public Health, Scott Gettiman, Assistant Superintendent for Public and Legislative Affairs at Yosemite National Park. Also, Dr. D. Lacey, Infectious Disease Expert at Kaiser Permanente Fresno. So we have all the people here who can discuss this issue with us because it is of great concern, especially coming off a holiday where so many people visit the park. First of all, let me start with Dr. Vicki Kramer. How is the state responding to this outbreak?
The California Department of Public Health is working very closely with Yosemite and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to fully identify the risk of contracting hantavirus in Curry Village and elsewhere in Yosemite, and rapidly taking steps to reduce that risk by controlling the rodent population, specifically the deer mouse, which is the reservoir of hantavirus, and also preventing these mice from entering buildings. So along with controlling the deer mouse population, it is important that the public become educated regarding the signs and symptoms of hantavirus. So especially if they have been in Curry Village and they do get ill, it's important that they seek medical attention.
Now, officials are describing this outbreak at Yosemite as rare and unprecedented. Now, put this outbreak in context with the others in the state since 1993, when that virus was first identified.
That's right. West Nile hantavirus was first identified in 1993, and since then we've had 63 cases of hantavirus reported to the state. the highest number of cases reported from the Eastern Sierra, but we previously did have two cases reported from Yosemite, one in 2000 and one in 2010. Both of those individuals exposed in Tuolumne Meadows. But all the other cases have been isolated incidents. This is the first time that we've had a cluster of cases.
Now, you, the state, you were concerned about this even last year.
We have been trapping and testing deer mice throughout California since 1993. Literally thousands and thousands of deer mice, and of those, about 14% have tested positive for evidence of hantavirus. So I think it's important for listeners to keep in mind that this isn't unique to Yosemite National Park, that indeed we have infected deer mice in many regions of California, particularly at the higher elevations with greatest risk in the Eastern Sierra in Mono and Inyo counties in particular. And we have been providing recommendations not only to the National Park Service, but also to the U.S. Forest Service and other wilderness areas in the state on steps that need to be taken to reduce the risk of individuals getting hantavirus, not only their employees, but also visitors. The National Park Service took the initiative to enter into a memorandum of understanding with us for 3 years, providing us with additional funds to intensify the work that we did in Yosemite as well as other national parks in California. So we have been working with them for many years, dating back to 1995.
Was there any indication that this season was going to be worse at all, that you were going to have this kind of an outbreak?
Not really. Certainly the deer mouse population seems to be greater this year than in the last several years. Last year, for instance, we had no reported cases of hantavirus, whereas this year, prior to the Yosemite cases, we already had two reported to the California Department of Public Health. One, we're not sure of the travel history there, but the second from Mono County. So really no big red flags. Until we had that second case of hantavirus from Curry Village, that was our first red flag. We had one case there, and then the second case really indicated to us that, you know, something unusual may be going on.
I'd like to ask Dr. D. Lacey some questions at this point, because we're talking about, you know, the number of people who have been infected. But there is the possibility that there could be many more. Now, what should people look for? I mean, first of all, how is this spread?
Well, the infection is shed by the deer mice in their saliva, their urine, and their feces.
I mean, so, from person to person, maybe. Does that happen,
no,
or is it
there
no?
Is no person-to-person transmission.
Okay.
So we don't have to worry about getting it from each other, but we do have to worry about going into a location that may have may have been living in.
So how long would it take for people to start experiencing symptoms if they were exposed at all?
The incubation period is from 1 to 6 weeks.
Okay.
So a lot of people who went to Yosemite earlier in the summer are already outside of that window and don't need to be worried.
What should people look for? What are the symptoms?
Right. Now, the initial symptoms are what we call nonspecific. That means they don't really tell you, ooh, this is what I have. They're very much like a lot of other things, unfortunately, which would be chills, fever, muscle aches. And then people may feel better for a couple of days, but then the key symptom is it becomes difficult to breathe, and the disease gets worse very rapidly at that point. So they might develop a dry cough, feel sick, headache, nausea, vomiting, and the shortness of breath, difficulty breathing, is the alarm symptom that they really need to pay attention to and get in to be seen immediately if they have that.
What is the treatment for this?
Unfortunately, there is no specific treatment. Treatment is supportive, and in many cases when they get the respiratory illness that involves supportive care in the ICU, including putting people on breathing machines.
So it's very serious because it's there is no cure for it, and what you're saying right now, there's no treatment for
right.
this.
There's no specific treatment. There's just supportive treatment.
Just how does it impact people?
50% of the people who get the severe respiratory illness, despite being put on breathing machines, will die. And that even includes people who were previously healthy. So it can be very deadly. We don't really see the mild illnesses. Perhaps they don't come forward. Probably Dr. Kramer could comment on that. But it can be devastating.
Dr. Kramer, as she was saying, that it can be, and you don't see mild cases of this?
Well, certainly there's a spectrum of illness associated with hantavirus, but unlike West Nile virus, where 80% of individuals infected by that virus have no symptoms at all, we don't find that with hantavirus. Typically, people that are infected with this virus will get sick, obviously some seriously ill, but there will be some individuals that come through this more easily. And interestingly, children seem to be less affected by hantavirus than older individuals. In fact, the youngest case noted in California is about 11 or 12 years old. And that may be because a child's immune system is not as well developed, and the response to hantavirus is part of the immune system responding to that virus and causing the lungs to fill up with fluid. So I guess that's good news for children, that they're less likely to become ill from hantavirus infection. And there may be other factors contributing to children not getting this virus as well, but that certainly is one reason why we haven't seen a lot of illness in children.
Is this a situation where when you have, when you put humans out into the wild, there are always these risks and possibilities?
Certainly, that's very true. I think Yosemite National Park has identified a lot of risks for visitors to their parks, and this is one of many, but certainly a very important one. And I think it's critical for the public, again, to know that this is a rodent-borne disease. The virus is shed in the urine droppings or saliva of the mice, and that it's very important not to sweep, not to dust, not to vacuum if you do see rodent feces or rodent nesting material. First, try to avoid rodents, but if you do have to clean up with them, and this isn't so much the case in Curry Village where there's a cleaning crew, but if you are in any other types of cabins or dwellings, make sure that you wet down those droppings or nesting material with a bleach solution, wait a few minutes, and then clean that up using paper towels, of course, wear gloves if possible, or put your hand in a plastic bag, and clean up the moistened, sanitized droppings or nesting material that way. And if you have to clean up a broad area, again, don't sweep, don't vacuum. Try to spray down the area with a bleach solution first, and this prevents the virus from becoming aerosolized. And air out any facilities that have been closed up for some time that may have rodent contamination. And, of course, try to prevent rodents from coming into any cabins or dwellings in the first place.
Dr. Kramer, we're talking about Yosemite, but do we see this as at the possibility of the same kind of outbreak at other parks as well?
We certainly have the possibility of other cases in wilderness areas throughout California. Whether we have risk for an outbreak situation is not well defined because we're still trying to figure out exactly why we have cases associated with a particular building type at Curry Village, specifically the signature cabins, which have a tent or canvas-like outside, and then inside that there is a drywall. So whether the particular structure there is posing a risk to the public or not, we're still exploring that. But certainly there is a risk of getting hantavirus in many regions of California. So I think overall recommendations to the public hold regardless of whether you're at Yosemite or somewhere else.
They also hold if you're in your own home and the rodents are coming in.
Yes, that is true, although in our urban and suburban areas, you're more likely to encounter the house mouse than the deer mouse. So the risk in urban and suburban areas and down in the lowlands of the valley are certainly less than up at our higher elevations.
Okay. When you were talking about, what is it about the cabins or the structure of the cabins at Yosemite of where the, you know, the mice were able either to get in or nest, or what is it about their structure?
I think that's still under investigation.
Okay. But right now, that's what you're looking at, because the cases were kind of all kind of traced back to Curry Village, correct?
Well, four of the six so far have been traced back to the signature cabins at Curry Village. The fifth individual was at Curry Village, and the sixth person was in Yosemite Park, and the exact travel history is still being determined.
How did this, or did it impact, if either one of you know, over Labor Day at all? Because from what I'm reading, you're a lot of international guests visit Yosemite. It's not so much local. It's from people all over the world. And what are you hearing from them?
Probably Yosemite National Park, Scott, would be the best to answer
right.
that question.
Okay. How are you working with, Dr. Kramer, how are you working with officials at Yosemite on this outbreak?
We're working very closely with public health officials and the rangers in Yosemite. And Yosemite has taken many steps to address the problem, and they're continuing to do so. Our staff have visited Curry Village twice and will be returning again this week to help evaluate risk factors and take appropriate steps. I know that Yosemite has indefinitely closed the signature cabins. There's 91 cabins, and relocated those guests to other facilities in Curry Village or elsewhere in the park.
When was the state first made aware of the outbreak of the cases by Yosemite officials?
Well, we first learned of the initial case about a month ago through the usual reporting system in the state. We're notified about hantavirus cases, most typically from our local health departments, who are in turn notified by a physician or laboratory. And then in turn, because this is a reportable disease in California, we are notified, and then we follow up appropriately with the local health officer and, in this case, Yosemite National Park.
Okay. What should people do, people who are thinking of visiting the park, from a health perspective as far as how to protect themselves and maybe not come in contact with this virus or mice?
Well, I certainly want to encourage individuals to still travel to Yosemite. It's a beautiful place, as you know, and it's important for people to take advantage of that and to get exercise and fresh air. However, while there, avoiding contact with rodents would certainly be recommended, in particular if they see signs of a rodent infestation, not to disturb that rodent infestation and run the risk of inhaling that virus.
And Dr. Lacey, what you were saying, that all people have to do then is just inhale it?
Right. Well, right. So they, as they're cleaning up, as Dr. Kramer was saying, you know, avoiding sweeping and vacuuming and other, you know, vigorous dusting, things that could put the dust into the air, because all you have to do is inhale it, and then the virus is taken up from there. You could also get it by being bitten by an animal, but that is less likely to happen.
Dr. Kramer, just another question here, and you may have answered it, and I'm sorry if I'm asking you again, but is there the possibility that we would end up seeing, as you know, the population grows, as more people come in contact with animals, and, you know, deer come in closer contact or proximity to campgrounds and people, is there the possibility that we could end up seeing more cases of hantavirus?
Well, it's certainly possible as more and more people spend time in areas where we have abundant deer mice populations. And remember, this really has nothing to do with deer. These mice are just called deer mice, I think perhaps because of their big ears. I'm not sure why their common name is the deer mouse. But it's certainly possible as, you know, people do spend more time outdoors and start to live in more rural areas, that we could see more cases of hantavirus. And it's certainly possible with increased public awareness and increased awareness in the medical community that cases previously not attributed to hantavirus could now be correctly attributed to hantavirus, and patients could be tested. Certainly, many cases of infectious diseases are not reported to, either not correctly identified or not reported to the state. And as public education increases and the medical community becomes more aware of the signs and symptoms of hantavirus, it's possible that more cases could be reported to the state. Now, so it's kind of a twofold thing. You know, you have people moving into these areas and then greater awareness.
Now, Dr. Lacey, I'm just following up on something. What Dr. Kramer said is that not all cases are reported, and some people may not know. I mean, when you take a look at the symptoms, is there a situation, and I don't even know if they can have mild cases, but a situation where a person could get sick and recover and not know that maybe they had a hantavirus?
Yeah, that would be a possibility. Like Dr. Kramer was saying, we don't really know completely the spectrum of this illness. And so as typically with an illness like this, where there's not a positive blood culture or something that would let people know, if you don't consider the diagnosis, you don't make the diagnosis, and then somebody comes in with a flu-like illness, and they're told, you have a flu-like illness, and they go home and they get better, then the diagnosis would probably never be made.
And with this being a bigger case than what, you know, the park has experienced, do you have to handle that a different way, Dr. Kramer?
Absolutely. Isolated cases, we do follow up on those cases and conduct surveillance to identify risk factors and make sure that rodent ingress into buildings is addressed and people in and around that area are educated so we don't have further cases in that particular location. In this instance, because we do have a cluster of cases, it's been very important for Yosemite to notify visitors who stayed in these signature cabins about hantavirus and their potential exposure so that if they do become ill, as mentioned, with these flu-like symptoms or they have difficulty breathing, they're coughing, that they immediately see their physician, because although there's no specific treatment for hantavirus, the earlier that it's recognized, the earlier that individuals can get that supportive care for their lungs and their heart, and the better the chance of survival. Keep in mind that about a third of individuals die who get this infection. We've had 21 deaths in California of our 63 cases. So it is very serious and very important to get that early care. And this will strike individuals who previously were perfectly healthy. So there's not really underlying medical conditions that predispose somebody to getting sick from hantavirus.
Okay. We were hoping to have Scott Gettiman join us this morning, to shed more light on this as far as exactly what the park is doing. But before we go, I would like for Dr. Lacey again, for people out there, if you could just sum up and talk about what should people look for, symptoms, that sort of thing, so people will be left with that information.
Sure. So if there are people out there who were in Curry Villages, especially in these cabins, these tent cabins, in the last 1 to 6 weeks, what they should be looking for is a flu-like illness, so chills, fever, muscle aches, which might temporarily get better and then come back again, and be accompanied by a dry cough, feeling sick, which we call malaise, headache, nausea, vomiting, and shortness of breath. If they were to get those symptoms, it would be very important for them to come into their, go into their physician immediately and say, look, I was in Yosemite where they're having this hantavirus outbreak, and I think I might have that illness. And then, you know, if they have papers like the CDC and the California Department of Public Health both have lots of information about this on hantavirus, or their physician can Google it and see what testing needs to be done to help support or refute the diagnosis.
And again, we're talking about what time period? Let's say if they were at Yosemite, between what time and what time period? I think you said 6 weeks or...
6 weeks is the outer limit.
Okay.
So we're looking at going back to the end of July now.
Okay. So if people were in Yosemite or they stayed in Curry Village back during that time, it's important that maybe they just be more aware.
Right.
And kind of watch themselves for any of these symptoms. And if they do manifest themselves, not waste any time seeing a doctor just to be safe.
And I'd like to also mention Tuolumne Meadows, because we have had two cases associated with the Tuolumne Meadows High Sierra area of Yosemite as well. So it's not just Curry Village. I think, you know, anybody who's been to the High Sierra should keep in mind those symptoms. And I also want to mention one common question I get is, you know, can my dog or cat get hantavirus? And the answer to that is no. Although they may have the virus, they could be exposed to the virus. They're not going to develop any symptoms. So you don't need to worry about your pets if you took them with you up into the Sierra.
Okay. So it's not just Yosemite. Just if you've been in the Sierras, mountainous areas where these rodents are, you just need to be aware.
That's right.
Right.
Okay. Well, thank you both. Dr. Vicki Kramer, California Department of Public Health, and Dr. Dee Lacey, she's an infectious disease expert with Kaiser Permanente here in Fresno. Thank you both for joining us and just trying to educate the public more about this disease and what they should be on the lookout for. We thank you both for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
Of the nation's 100 highest paid corporate chief executive officers, a quarter received more in compensation than their companies paid in income taxes last year. That's from a study released less than 2 weeks ago by the Institute for Policy Studies. High pay and compensation packages for top corporate executives is nothing new. But on this edition of FM 89's commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State business professor Ida Jones says high CEO pay isn't necessarily tied to good job performance.
What's the value of a typical worker's contribution to a company's success compared to that of CEOs of the largest companies? The CEO's contribution is about 380 times more valuable, according to the AFL-CIO's 2012 Annual Report on Pay Disparity. Not only is it more valuable, but its value rises faster than inflation. Last year, average CEO pay rose 14% to nearly $13 million. What was your pay raise last year? Now, CEOs have a great deal of serious responsibilities, including accountability for a company's success or failure. CEOs have vice presidents and other officers who help them with oversight of business operations. But ultimately, the buck stops with the CEO. CEOs deserve to get paid a great deal. However, you would think that that pay would be tied to the company's long-term performance. It's not necessarily. So how, you may ask, is a CEO's pay calculated? Well, in the largest companies, CEO pay is figured out by a compensation committee. The board of directors and the CEOs choose the members of that committee. And since the members of the committee are usually CEOs themselves, they have an interest in keeping pay high. CEOs don't want to upset their colleagues and don't want to be viewed as mediocre. So, according to Warren Buffett, a man who has a reputation for being a fair CEO, during the compensation committee meetings, too often collegiality trumped independence. So I ask you, when was the last time you were able to vote or decide what your pay or pay raise would be? To add insult to injury, CEO pay is not based on performance. CEO pay rises even though company performance has been average or worse. Many boards use a formula that calculates compensation. They set their own CEO's pay so that it fits within the top 25% of CEOs. Setting high pay for CEOs differs from setting high pay for athletes and performers. Athletes' pay is negotiated based on performance and evaluation of net return on investment. Some athletes supplement their pay through product endorsements negotiated based on the anticipated impact of their endorsement on product sales. Actors, actresses, and musicians' pay is based on historical and expected returns from ticket or music sales. Not so with CEOs. Note that leaders and other business executives claim that high CEO pay is essential to attract and keep the best CEOs. The argument is that these CEOs create jobs for workers and profits for shareholders. However, this argument is not borne out by statistics. According to two economists, one from NYU and the other from MIT, the difference in performance of the top executives is less than 2%. So how does this pay gap affect employees? According to Peter Drucker, who many call the father of modern management theory, CEO pay of more than 20 to 25 times the average worker's pay reflected poor leadership. Leadership founded on privilege rather than responsibility. According to the studies, wide pay gaps can create resentment, affect employee morale, productivity, and turnover. Solutions? I strongly support the Dodd-Frank Act's requirement that the Securities and Exchange Commission adopt a rule that requires companies to close the gap between the median pay of company employees and that of the CEOs. If Whole Foods and Costco can do it, so can others. For The Moral Is, this is Ida Jones.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
And that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can also email us at talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.